Our speaker today is Dr. Glyn Harrison. Glyn is Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at Bristol University, where he was also a practicing consultant of psychiatry. He speaks widely on issues such as the one he is going to talk to us today about. So now I'm going to invite Glyn up to speak. Do join me in welcoming him.
Phil, thank you very much. I'm sure you can all hear me. It's good at the back, yeah? Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me along. Thank you for slipping this session into your busy day. Just a bit about myself. I'm a professor emeritus of psychiatry, which is a rather grand-sounding title that actually means retired. So I'm a retired psychiatrist, and that's given me some scope to do things like this, look at some subjects that have interested me and think about them in a bit more depth in relation to my faith as a Christian. So self-worth, how self-esteem ideology leaves us feeling emptier than ever? Well, is that the case? Well, I was up on the Parthenon, visiting the Parthenon up on the Acropolis for the very first time in the autumn, and I saw something else up there on a wonderful sunny morning. I saw something else up there that I hadn't seen before besides the Parthenon, and that was the selfie stick. I don't know whether anyone's got one of these in your handbag, in your bag just now, a little telescopic device. Very handy, and I didn't see one, I saw two, I saw three, they were all over the place for some reason on the top of the Acropolis. And you could say, you know, at one level, it's just a handy device, no more stopping strangers and having to get them to, you know, take a picture of you with your camera. You just set it up, this little telescopic thing out of your bag, and put yourself at the center of the picture. But I noticed shortly after that somebody tweeted about these things, and they said the selfie stick. I think we christen it from now on the Wand of Narcissus, which I thought was rather a good term. It got retweeted 2,000 to 3,000 times, which was interesting. The Wand of Narcissus. You remember Narcissus was in Greek mythology. He was so in love with his appearance, and in revenge, the god, aptly named Nemesis, lured him to the edge of the water, where he caught sight of himself and was so entranced by himself, he eventually fell in and drowned, literally, in himself. Narcissus, self-absorption, you see. And this idea of the Wand of Narcissus is signaling a sort of a cultural sense of discomfort that there are changes underway in the way, certainly in Western culture, in the way we view ourselves as human beings, and that those changes aren't necessarily all for the good. That's, I think, what's been signaled there with the Wand of Narcissus. Well, just sort of setting up how we're going to be spending the next 25 minutes, I'm going to spend about the first part trying to convince you that is the case. That sense of discomfort that there's something going on in the way we view ourselves and that it's not entirely for the good, that is a well placed view. There's evidence for that, and I want to try and convince you of that, at least argue for it. And then in the second part, I want to say, well, how does the Christian faith relate to this issue of self-worth, significance, importance, who I am? Okay, so there are the two parts. So let's take the first part. You know, how have attitudes to ourselves been changing over the past few years? In fact, they've been changing over the past few decades. This has got a mind of its own, this thing. It's jumping around. But these are American students, so not necessarily immediately transferable over here. But these American students who rate their abilities above average, mapped out between 1965 and 2010, and you can see, well, let's just pick out, it's hard to see, but let's pick out intellectual self-confidence, the green one there, and you can see that in 1965, 40% rated themselves as above average intellectual ability. You might like to pause for a minute, think, how would I rate myself, above average, average, or below average? But several decades later, 60% rated themselves above average. And similarly, on leadership ability, it was 40, now it was 60. Now, it may be that our intellectual abilities have increased 50%. It may be that our leadership competences, you know, at student age have increased by that much. But maybe it's also simply that the way we think and evaluate ourselves has become more sort of positive. There are other indicators of change. This is something called the NPI score over a similar period between the year 1980 through to 2006. The NPI is the Narcissism Personality Inventory, and it's a quick and dirty survey instrument that's quite well standardized, for those of you that know this kind of thing, to measure what you'd call narcissistic traits. These are the sort of traits of personality that like to see me at the center, that like to be the center of attention, that like to attract people's attention to me, that lead me to slightly unrealistic views of my abilities as being better than others, that traits that lead me to ride roughshod over other people's feedback because I'm so absorbed with myself. That's narcissism, what the NPI. And you can see that over a similar period, scores, certainly amongst college students, have been elevating over that time. And it's an interesting phenomenon as to what's been going on. These are publications in major news outlets on self-esteem, this subject that we're all quite interested in today, self-esteem. And you can see, again, over a similar period, look at this rocketing interest. And I have a Google alert on self-esteem. Every morning into my inbox comes 10, 12 articles from newspapers that, you know, this makes your self-esteem better, that makes it worse. Here's a way of improving it, but don't, and so on and so forth. We are obsessed with this sort of issue. And then, this is a bit hard to see, this is a Google Ngram. And you know a Google Ngram, it's quite interesting. They look at the proportional occurrence of a particular word in a set of books between the years 1800 and 2005. Okay, and so this is the occurrence of the word self-control. And you can see that through the Dickensian period, this word gets much, much more common in this corpus of books that are being looked at. Its occurrence gets self-control, which is sort of Victorians would be interested in self-control. And then it peaks just after the First World War and then falls again and plateaus off. Now, here's something that comes up the fast lane to overtake it. And what word do you think that is that occurs? It's self-esteem. It's this word that took off in the 1960s, basically. And what we might ask ourselves is, well, why? Why did we suddenly become so interested in this concept of self-worth? And I think the answer to that is because people like me, I'm a psychiatrist, which is a medic who then developed more broadly into psychology, but people like me, psychologists and counselors, came to the view that having a good sense of self-worth is quite integral to flourishing as human beings. And I think there's something in that. The problem is we overdid it, but there's something in it. You need to have a good basic sense of your worth if you're going to flourish, if you're going to bounce back after a disappointment, if you're going to be a hungry learner who wants to know more and doesn't mind failing sometimes to get more information, if you're going to be the kind of person who forms good relationships, that it's not always about you, it's about them as well, that you need to have a good basic sense of that you're worth something, and people who beat themselves down find it harder to flourish, to relate to people. And so psychologists around the 60s became really captured by this idea that having a good sense of self-worth is important. And I think there's something in that. But then, second, they made another very interesting observation, that we go looking for self-worth in all kinds of unhelpful places and unhelpful ways. We try to build up our self-worth in all kinds of counterproductive ways. I mean, I'll just run a couple of them past you. We're we're tight for time, but you know, what are the ways you can boost your sense of self-worth? Well, one is by sort of being good, achieving. Who's this? Johnny Wilkinson, the rugby player. And here we are. And most of you, I don't know whether you remember this. I said it in 2003, so it's, you know, 12 years ago, 28 seconds before the end, with that famous drop goal, he wins the World Cup for England over Australia. And overnight, you know, if you had to be there in a way to sense the euphoria. Overnight, he became a national hero, a sort of national treasure, wheeled into Buckingham Palace, through London streets on a, you know, on a double decker and so on. This that moment, that dropped goal, surely was everything that little boy of eight when he first went out on the rugby pitch, everything he wanted. And yet in his book, his autobiography, Tackling Life, he says that within hours of that kick, not days, not months, within hours, he says, I was tumbling out of control. You see, I'm only as good as my last kick. I'm afflicted with a powerful fear of failure, and I didn't know how to free myself from it. And he got quite depressed. Now, isn't that an interesting term? Only as good as my last kick. And you might say, well, yeah, only as good a kicker as his last kick. No, he means more than that. He means that his kicks go quite deep in who he is. That who he is seems to be staked on how good his kicks are. And that's what keeps him kicking, because you're only ever as good as the last try. And that's the treadmill that trying to stake our self-worth on achievement, being good in whatever way being good means for you. That's the treadmill it draws us onto. Being good, what's another way of building up your self-worth? Doing what I'm doing now, being seen. You know, the father of modern economics, Adam Smith, he wrote in 1798, a really interesting observation. He said, he put his mind to the question of what drives us on to want to better ourselves? What is that? And he wrote this. He said, to what purpose is all the toil and bustle of this world? What is the end of greed and ambition, of the pursuit of wealth, power, and preeminence? Why do we do this? Is it to supply food and drink and clothes? Now, the wages of the poorest labourer can get you a pair of jeans from Primark. That's what he's basically saying. So what then are the advantages of that great purpose of human life, which we call bettering our condition? Why do we seek this? And this was his answer as an economist: to be observed, to be attended to be noticed. Now, it's possible that one or two came here hoping no one had noticed you, but most people will have come here hoping that someone had looked their way at some point. The human spirit, we're deeply social creatures, and we want to be noticed. And one of the ways of boosting your sense of self-worth is to build it on being noticed. People look your way. People see you. I was talking to a group of lawyers on Saturday. This is a big issue for them, the issue of status. You see, the higher you get, the better you feel. And of course, the guy on the top feels best of all. You know, it's been said that psychology began in a chicken coop, because we observe patterns in the way chickens relate, and thought, I wonder whether human beings, their behavior follows patterns. And so, interestingly, from the chicken yard, we get terms like, you know, someone taken under your wing, or did you ruffle their feathers? But what's the commonest term that describes human behavior that we get from the chicken yard? Pecking order. The tendency amongst humans to organize ourselves into hierarchies of importance. And the guy on the top has made it. And the point is that status, when you can get it, being seen, being noticed is an intoxicating thing for many of us. We just want more because it makes us feel worthwhile, significant. And it isn't necessarily the material goods that come with status, the title, the money, the Mercedes, the big house, the bigger desk, the car parking space. No, it's actually what really gives you the buzz is the non-verbal things, just the deference, the little pull back at the door as you're the boss walk through. You say, oh no, please don't. You're pleased they did, deep inside. Because a big bit of us wants to be noticed, to be seen, and the more we can get of that, the more worthwhile we feel ourselves to be. Of course, the problem with status is it makes you feel good. It also makes you feel very, very bad. Why? Because the other guys don't like it down there, and they're learning to kick. And some of them begin to kick faster and harder and more accurately and better than you. So you've just got to keep on kicking and running and achieving, and there's no end. And so going back to the 60s, these psychologists, they were right when they said, you can't stake your sense of self-worth on being good or achievement. It's got to be something else. That was a good diagnosis. They said this is what they called contingency. This is self-worth that's contingent on, dependent on, that's seduced by these other aspects, these achievements, these being goods. We've got to free ourselves from that. How do we do it? Here's what they came up with. Self-esteem. You say what you're worth. Just say it. And if you can just get the word just in front of it, it slides out even. You just need to say, I'm important. I'm worthy. In fact, you know, the self-esteem movement will provide you with all kinds of aids and books and courses. I love me. I am powerful, unlimited, certain, strong. I attract positive people and events into my life now. And if you're of a religious turn of mind, you can even get, when God made, I may be little, but to God I'm big stuff, you see. And we can all pile in on this, what some psychologists, particularly Martin Seligman, the great positive psychologist, call boosterism. This idea that you just say yourself what you're worth. Don't depend on other people's approval, the feedback and all of that. You say it. You say what you're worth. And it sounds good, doesn't it? Self-esteem. The question is, does it work? That's the question. And the evidence is, well, let me show you some of the evidence. This was a study carried out in Canada, and ever so quickly they divided a big sample up into three groups. It was a randomized trial. And they randomized them to one of three groups. In the first group, you got a bunch of cards like this, and you were told to have a 20-minute sort of meditation on them every day in which you thought positively of yourself using these cards. Boosterism, you see. And the second group, they were given the same cards but told to think, well, how is this true and how is this not true of me? And the third group were told to do nothing at all. So when they followed them up at 3 and 6 months, what did they find? Who'd done best? Who was helped the most? Well, interestingly, what they found was the people in this group who had the cards and focused positively on them, by the end of the study, the ones who'd gone into it with low self-esteem felt worse than when they'd gone in. It actually made people feel worse. And the psychology, it was a nice study. They said the only conclusion we can make is that these self-affirming statements may help people already feel pretty great about themselves, feel even greater, but they backfire for the people who need them most. Now, why do you think that is? I'll tell you what I think. I think it's because it's hard to believe your own propaganda, especially if you've got low self-esteem, you know. It's hard, you know, just you say it, just putting the word just in front of it doesn't make it right. I am worthy. I am special. Who says? What basis? And so psychologists are moving on from self-esteem now, as more of this evidence has accumulated, it's going out of fashion, and they're looking at other ways of thinking about ourselves that aren't sort of pivoted on what makes me feel good. And some psychologists are getting really interested in thinking much more about identity and purpose. Actually, even, Alistair McIntyre, the moral philosopher, says, look, if you think about it, there's a close relationship between worth and purpose. It's hard to know what a thing's worth if you don't know what it's for. So, if a Martian drops, in front of you from outer space and you give him a screwdriver and you say, how much is that worth? And he looks at it. He has no idea what it is. So he can't tell you what it's worth. He doesn't know what it's for. So he can't tell you what its value is. But then you see, if you show him a door that you'd both like to get through and the handle's fallen off and there are a couple of screws by it on the floor, and you pick up the handle and you put the screw and you show him how you use this instrument, now he knows what it's for. Now he can tell you something about its worth. And so psychologists are beginning to link worth with purpose and meaning. We need a sense of goal, of purpose, which is more than about keeping me feeling good. And some of those ideas are certainly, I think, are healthier psychologically than these self-absorbed scenarios that we've been talking about. But I want to just finish by talking about how does the Christian faith relate to this issue of worth and significance? What does the Christian faith have to say about that? And I'm pleased these are on your chairs, and I do hope you'll take it away. It's John's Gospel from the Bible, and there are a couple of verses that I just wanted to pick out from this that speak to this issue quite powerfully, I think. And the first verse to pick out is the very first verse in the whole of the gospel, and it's this: in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then look at verse 12. Yet to all who did receive him, the Word, all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. And these are magisterial verses. They're really interesting. And if you've not seen them before, I'd really invite you to just reflect on them, because they're saying three very important things about God. First thing is, they're saying that he speaks. He's a God who speaks. He's spoken, in fact. That word, he spoke. We're not alone. We're not making ourselves up as we go along. We're not trying to figure it out, patching things together. He spoke. He communicated. It's a big, big, deep truth that the Christian faith holds. But then the second bit is perhaps even more important. The second bit is, first, he's a God who speaks. The same thing about God here is, he speaks about himself. Again, we're not left to figure it out as we go along, to patch it together from bits and pieces that we discover, that we happen across. You will never get God taped. He'll never become the object of your imagination in the sense that you will completely understand him. He can't. He's God. He'll always be above your understanding and mine as creatures. But he has spoken, and he has spoken of himself, and revealed himself. And the word was word. And of course, this term word, it's the Bible's word for Jesus. And the wonderful thing about God speaking is that he not only spoke in words, because Jesus spoke in words, but he spoke in flesh, because Jesus was, Christians believe, God become man. And so God speaks, shows us, reveals, not simply by speaking, but by showing what he's like in flesh. He becomes a human being. He spoke about himself. But then here's the third thing, which links to what we're talking about. He spoke about you as well and me. And what he revealed was that people who dwell in darkness, people who are in the dark, people who open their hearts or themselves to the Word, to his Son, to knowing him, something happens. They become something. They become children of God. I don't know whether you noticed that verse 12. To those who did receive him, he gave the right to become children of God. This is an extraordinary thing, because it means that for those who receive him, God speaks their identity as his child. And that changes everything. It changes everything about you. You become a child of the creator of the worlds himself, his own son or daughter. And this is a deep, thick sense of identity, which speaks about worth, purpose, which gives you a sense of meaning, which begins to put some sense of direction into your life, because now you're not building your identity on what other people think, or what the last kick you did was, or the last exam, or the last bit of feedback. You're not building an identity on that. You're living out of an identity into that. You're achieving because you're living out this identity of being a child of God. And that means that you've got an identity. If you would receive this, or look into it with a, you know, think, is this something? If you did receive it, you would have an identity which is ultimately non-contingent. What do I mean by that? It doesn't depend on what other people think or what other people say. And it certainly doesn't depend on your last kick any more than my love for my grandson depends on his last, you know, piece of behavior. No, I love him. And God's love for those who receive him is none. He will never, ever let you go. It's that kind of a thing. So it's an identity that doesn't depend on what other people think. And here's the thing. It doesn't even depend on what you feel today, because God spoke it. Your identity is in him. He spoke about you as the same way he spoke about himself. You're his child if you receive it. And it changes everything. And so I just want to finish on that note, because I think that's what we're invited to do when we're sort of invited to read this book, to go on a journey that may just change everything about us, about the way we feel about ourselves, think about ourselves, about the way we live our whole lives. And I know that, you know, if somebody brought you along, if this is sort of weird and it's not your thing, sort of religion, faith, they'd love to just talk about some more of the things in this book with you. I know that if they're Christians. And you know, I'd be glad to chat, and I look forward to some questions in a moment, Phil, and push back as well as questions, or if you've got any wisdom you can help me out with, just feel free to chip in. So thank you very much. Any, do you want to come back, push back, clarify? Want me to amplify any bits, or? Yes, guy there.
I think quite a lot of my friends, if I was talking to them about this, would say that their identity didn't depend on other people. There's, like, I know quite a popular aphorism is like, haters are going to hate.
Like what?
Haters are going to hate.
Yeah.
What would you say to that?
The problem is psychiatrists often say things like what I'm just about to say, but underneath, you see, underneath it. And I'm actually quite suspicious of that as a scientist as well, because, you know, that's an unprovable sort of assertion, because underneath that means you, the expert, can always see. But having made that caveat, I do think underneath there's a lot of bravado. But there are some quite sophisticated psychological experiments which show that our behavior is really, really sensitive to what other people think around us. We are deeply social human beings. And our behavior changes quite a lot depending on our sense of whether we're being seen or not. So people, for example, when they think they're not being seen, behave quite callously. And can write, you know, behave in a really uncaring way. So you set up these scenarios. When people think they're being seen, we become very righteous and very keen to, you know, to show up. So you've got to have a bit of a pinch of salt behind what people say. I think the weight of the evidence is we do care what people think quite a lot. And that's why we want more stuff to impress them, you know, and so on. So yes.
As a Christian, it's for me, I don't doubt that I'm loved and that my self-worth lies in that. But for non-Christians or people without faith, how, like, do they have an option kind of thing? Can they still have a strong sense of self-worth that isn't reliant on...
That's an interesting point, isn't it? Yeah, I do think that there are other ways of generating sense of self-worth that get you by in life. You know, I happen to think that the Christian narrative is what I call the thickest narrative identity. It's got the most in it that answer a lot of these issues. But there are other ways of generating a sense of worth. You know, someone who says, look, I'm an eco-warrior. You know, my big goal in life is to make this world a better place. I have no doubt that that is better for you psychologically than self-absorption. So, you know, there are better ways than this, no doubt, and psychologists can help us with that. I just, for me, and this is just my story, but for me, the Christian faith roots that in a really thick narrative, which is to do with the deepest question of all, which is who am I in the face of the universe? Am I loved in the emptiness of the universe? And I think it answers those questions at the same time. And of course, the big question it answers that I thought I'd leave a bit until the question, but the big question it answers is that. You know, when it says in John chapter 1, verse 12 there, and he gave them the right to become the children of God, a bit of a, so what right do I have to become a child of God? And is it the right I earn by doing stuff or by being seen? Is it back to that agenda? And of course, the key word in verse 12 is he gave the right. I've got the right because he gave it. It's a gift. That's what makes it so non-contingent. But of course, he gave the right because he earned the right for us to become children of God by dying in our place, by dealing with the shadow side of our character and personality. And that's the bit I didn't touch on, because you can't get everything in a 25-minute talk, but in any sense of identity has to deal with the issue of the reality of what we are when no one's looking. And the shadow side to ourselves. What narcissism does is it makes people immune to that kind of reflecting on yourself. And that's why when Jesus went around, he was so bold, because his ministry was, repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand. You know, which was, you're not as good as you think you are. That's what repent means. But here's something you can be part of that's bigger. That is not the way to be popular, say, particularly in today's culture. Say that, repent. But the Christian gospel, it actually deals in reality. It deals with the kind of people we are. And it offers redemption because it's dealt with at the cross. And we're given the gift of becoming children of God. So, yeah, a bit of a long answer to a great question. Thank you. Yeah, please.
You mentioned on your graphics the distinction between self-control and self-esteem. Mm. Do you think that one, you know, succeeded the other, and how do you think self-control as a concept fits into our society now?
Yeah, it's great. What a great question. Thank you. What was the first? Do I think what was the first part? I got the second bit. Does it fit into society? But right, yeah. It's very interesting because what makes us uniquely human is this capacity for self-reflection, isn't it? That we go into dialogue with ourselves. It's the essence of consciousness, really, that we both have a sense of me and then a sense of I and then a sense of me. And I think sometimes I don't like the way me behaves. I don't like those urges that bubble up or that stuff. So we are in dialogue with ourselves. It's a really fascinating, fundamental feature of human consciousness that we have this sense of self-awareness. So the notion of self-control is a well-grounded one because it acknowledges that there are aspects of, there are human urges, there are human desires which need to be subject to scrutiny, that need to be put under the microscope and sifted out and controlled. So self-control is a wonderful virtue, provided it's not over-control. You know, because the problem with over-control is it gives us a sense of godlikeness that we control everything, and that's where we become very rigid personalities, you know, seeking to control ourselves and everyone around us. But the notion of governing, I like the word self-governance. You know, all of us should be governing ourselves because there are things bubble up that aren't helpful, things from the past, things from our darker side that need to be controlled. And there's much more interest again now amongst psychologists in self-control, because self-esteem largely is dying as a really fertile concept. And there's much more interest in self-control, in resilience as well. And actually quite a lot of interest developing again in the virtues and character. Because of course, well, I mean, take the Cray twins. You know the Cray twins, big London criminals. They had probably great self-esteem. They probably had pretty good resilience. They could bounce back, you know. But character, you know. And that's why in schools people are saying, teachers are saying, you know, we've been teaching self-esteem. Kids mustn't fail. You know, everybody a winner. I went to a pass the parcel. When I was a kid, when you pass the parcel and with, you know, kids, there's only one present in the middle. I got invited to a party of a little 7-year-old friend of mine. And so I went along. And they had passed the parcel. And under every layer, you know, you rip a layer off when the music stopped, there was a present. I couldn't believe it. And what was amazing was that the music stopped at, somehow it managed to randomly stop at every child. So by the end, every child had exactly the same little bar of chocolate, including the one who got to the end, you know. And the mother, I said, how come they've all, you know, and she said, oh, bad for their self-esteem, you see. So no one must fail. Everyone must win. And schools are saying, we've had years of this. Is it really, are we just developing narcissism, narcissists? And even resilience, you can bounce back, but what if you bounce back and bounce on someone's nose, you know, faith? It's character. So schools are beginning to talk about much more about virtues and character, and I think there's something in that. So it's a great question, but I do think self-control is a really great thing, actually. Don't know if you want to come back or anybody else. Yes.
I was wondering, how do you find the balance between having a discussion about someone's self-worth and sounding kind of arrogant?
Yeah, well, it's a really good question. Like all these things, it's a matter of balance, isn't it? You know, having confidence in your abilities is a really important thing. If you're going to be competent, you need to have a confidence that you can do it. And the little trick I do on myself all the time is I think just because I'm a good whatever it is at the time, just because I'm a good psychiatrist at the moment, let's say, doesn't make me a great person. And so I always try to separate out the thing, the competence, from me as a person. Keep the two separate. And that helps, you know, combat arrogance. It means that you can be a brilliant footballer or a brilliant rugby player, but you say to yourself after that great kick, but they don't know how I talked to my wife yesterday or the kind of husband I'm being at the moment. And ultimately, who I am, I'm not going to stake on the last kick or the last argument with my wife. Deep down, it's staked on being loved and being a child of God. And then out of that, I want to contribute. I want to contribute to the flourishing of the world out of that, because I'm made in His image, and so I'm made to work out my identity into the world, to see the world flourishing. So the interesting thing is, you can have two people doing exactly the same thing, but from completely different motives. So let's say they're bankers, even, okay? Two bankers. One person can be banking, and he's doing it because he believes he's a child of God, and he believes that he's called to the flourishing of the world by being a good banker with integrity, you know, hard work, and wanting to reform some of the malicious aspects of that. So he's doing it, doing the same job, but for an entirely different motive. The guy over here is doing it to get his status as high as he can, and he's building his whole sense of identity on it. They're doing the same thing, but completely different motives. One's building his identity on it, the other, it's coming from his sense of identity. And that I think, is what the Christian story gives us.